Welcome to the Subversive Scribe Podcast, where we investigate the Hebrew Bible, Genesis through Chronicles, its instructions, teachings, and application. Learn how to interpret it correctly in context. Compare what it says in one part with another part, including and especially the New Testament. Let the text speak for itself in all its glory and in all its gore. Let the law, prophets, and writings be shield and spear. All it takes is the courage to hear it, seek it, and then decide on how you shall then live. The choice is always yours. I'm your show host, Jesse Heschel, and I invite you, even dare you, to join me on this journey on the Subversive Scribe Podcast. The biblical texts were always dangerous and subversive when allowed to speak on their own terms. Join the Scriven Insurgents, and let's get started with today's episode. All right, welcome to the Subversive Scribe Podcast. This is our first inaugural episode, one of hopefully many. Thank you for being with me on this journey and for taking the time to listen. I know that you have a lot of choices in your life of things that you can listen to. Not all of them are related to biblical studies and the Bible and how that relates to us today. So thank you again for being with me. I am your Subversive Scribe and intrepid host, Hesh. And today's episode is What's So Subversive About the Hebrew Bible? And the focus of the show stems from the Hebrew Bible. In Christianity, that's known as the Old Testament, though that's very much a misnomer and in some ways a slur. And I want to talk about the Hebrew Bible today. So that's Genesis through Chronicles in the arrangement by the Jewish tradition. And there's a reason why it's arranged that way and reasons why Christians have arranged their Bible to go from Genesis to Malachi. So what is the makeup of the Hebrew canon itself? So when I talk about a canon, or we talk about the Hebrew canon, we are talking about what Christians call the Old Testament. And a canon is a collection of texts or authorized books. And sometimes you'll hear the Hebrew Bible called the Tanakh, and that is an acronym of sorts. It stands for Torah, Prophets, and Writings. Or in Hebrew, it's Torah, Navaim, Ketuvim, or Tanakh, T-N-K, Tanakh. The consonantal system and the vowel system is different in Hebrew than it is in English. And of course, Hebrew reads right to left. So it's a much different way of understanding the world. And our understanding of the world is shaped by language. And that is the mechanism that we have in it, even as its limited form. It is the only mechanism we have, or the greatest mechanism we have, to describe the world. And we use words constantly, as you sit here and listen to me tell you words. So language itself is important because language shapes understanding, shapes cultural expectations, moral expectations. In some ways, it shapes our perception of reality around us. Now, I wouldn't go so far as to say that it shapes reality. That crosses more into a New Age kind of thinking line for me. However, our words do describe our perception of the reality around us. And that can be good, bad, neutral. It can be pretty, it can be ugly, it can be lots of things. That's an idea that comes from linguistics and philology and these other studies about language and how we use language. But for our purposes here, without getting too deep into that rabbit trail, is the Hebrew Bible, or the Tanakh. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the order of the Hebrew Bible, what Christians call the Old Testament, is arranged differently in each tradition. So, as I said, in the Hebrew tradition, or the Jewish tradition, it's arranged from what we call Genesis, the first book of the Bible, to Chronicles. And it's divided up between the Torah, or sometimes called the Law, though that's a misnomer, it's really more instruction, the Prophets, and the Writings. There is a reason to this, and it stems with the understanding of God's revelation through the Jewish experience and through time, really. And it's not that God just appeared on the mountain of Sinai, and it's not that God appeared to specific prophets like Ezekiel or Elijah, which is in more in the history books. That story is told to us in the history books, which would be the Book of Kings, Book of Samuel, Chronicles. And we, in the English world, and under the influence of Christianity, have separated those books into 1 Kings, 2 Kings, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles, where they might be just Kings A, Kings B. They're a continuation. They're one complete book. Kings and Samuel and Chronicles are. Chronicles is the later of those kind of historical books, but they don't actually fall under history books in the Jewish tradition. They fall under the prophets. And that's really important. That's to teach us the lesson that history itself has a message for us to understand. Now, the thing about the Hebrew Bible is that for Christians, they call it the Old Testament. And if you've ever sat in church for one day, you'll know this right away. But the Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh, it is the Bible of the New Testament. It is the Bible of Jesus. It is the Bible of the apostles. And it was the only Bible that they knew. The apostles didn't have the Gospel of Mark. They didn't have Romans. They didn't have Corinthians. They didn't have Jude. They didn't have all the things that come to make up the New Testament much later. So for them, their only Bible itself was the Law, the Prophets, and the Writings. They loved it. They sang psalms. They quoted from it. They're said to have quoted from it in the Gospel accounts. Jesus quotes from the Law, the Prophets, and the Writings. They immersed themselves in it. That was their life. I dare say if we got a time machine and we traveled back and we landed and we kidnapped Peter and we took him to some church here in wherever you live in the United States or in Europe or anywhere else, and you said, hey, what is this building? He would not understand that it was a church. He would not understand what a church was. He would consider it a pagan temple. He said, yeah, I've seen temples like that the pagans have. He wouldn't want to come in there. I dare say they would not step one foot in there. They would think that it was inappropriate, sinful even to do so, because they would think of it as a pagan temple. Because in their world, that's the kind of thing that pagans had. They wouldn't have accepted it. They wouldn't have seen Christianity as it is today. It would be so foreign to them, so alien to them. And I would include Jesus in that too. If he were to time travel here and we were to scoop him up in a UFO and we would drop him off, we would take him to, say, a Mormon church, a Mormon tabernacle in Salt Lake City, he would not dare step foot in it. He would see it as some kind of shrine to some other deity. He wouldn't understand it. He wouldn't think of it as just an extension of his own religion. Jesus himself was a Jew. He was a practicing Jew. He immersed himself in Torah. He read from the Law. He read from the Prophets. He read from the Writings. He studied it. He sang the Psalms. That was their hymn book. They didn't have elevation worship, and they didn't have Bethel, and they didn't have Hillsong, and didn't have all this other stuff. They wouldn't have understood it, and they would have rejected it flat out. The Torah, the Prophets, the Writings, that was their Bible. That's their Bible that they loved, that they defended, that they argued from, that they thought from. It is their planter box. It was God's planter box. And it meant everything to them. And that gets lost when we have discussions. When Christians see Jesus, they don't see Jesus the Jew. They don't see Peter. Well, they see Peter. They don't see Kepha. They don't see, which was his Hebrew name. They don't see those people. They see Judas. They don't see Judah. Judas is an anglicized Greco word for Judah. And Judah Maccabee was an important figure in the Jewish tradition. He was the main character of a group of brothers who fought against the leftover remnants of Alexander the Great. And he was a guerrilla fighter for a successful guerrilla operation. And that's what Hanukkah is every year. It's a celebration of rededication of the temple, but really it's a celebration of a successful guerrilla war, which is not very often. You can't find that many successful guerrilla operations. We've got the Maccabean Revolution about 200 years prior to the time that Jesus is said to have walked the earth. You've got 1776 and the American Revolution. You've got the Cuban Revolution, which was a successful revolution. Now that's a leftist revolution. And you might say that the Maccabean dynasty that was set up would be more of a royalist or monarchical revolution. And then the American Revolution would have been probably considered radical or leftist to the British. However, my point is, there's not that many successful guerrilla wars. And so it's a big deal to have one in the Jewish tradition. And mind you, that period of time, we pretty much have a closed canon at that point. So it's not that we're adding sacred books. And now the Catholic Church does do that. They add in 1st Maccabees, 2nd Maccabees, 3rd, 4th Maccabees, and they add some other books into their canon. But those are generally considered deuterocanonical or not canonical or pseudepigrapha, that kind of thing. So the Torah, the Prophets, the Writings, that's God's planter box. And they must comport with one another. At the very least, they can't contradict. And that's precisely the problem with the New Testament, Islam, and other religions, because they don't take the same positions that the Torah, the Prophets, and the Writings take. And that might be a hot take for you, it might be controversial for you, but stick around. And we'll demonstrate where these different religions say one thing, and it doesn't conflate with what the Torah or the Prophets or the Writings say. And they have to comport, but they cannot contradict. So there's two key components there. Now, something I want you to think about is the Torah itself means instruction. Now, it's kind of talked about in a negative light as the law, and the law is death, and the law does this, and the law does that, and it's a negative thing. However, it means instruction. Would you rather have instruction? Would you rather be left to your own devices? Or would you rather have a deity, a loving God that cares about you and that gives you instruction? That is the mindset that the Jewish tradition comes from. God so loved the world, he gave us instruction. That is the Jewish response to John 3:16. God so loved the world, he gave us instruction, because he could have left us to our own devices. Now, of course, Moses on the mountain was not the first lawgiver, or the first law translator, we might say, because God himself is the lawgiver and claims to be so in Isaiah and some other places. We have the Code of Hammurabi, we have Babylonian law, we have Assyrian law. People had laws. It wasn't like all of a sudden people woke up and said, oh my goodness, we shouldn't murder people. We had laws before that. This wasn't novel in some sense, but they were codified for the Israelite people, for a growing nation, birth of a nation. The Hebrew Bible starts with instruction, and it ends in wisdom. It ends in wisdom books. And that's a really important distinction, really important concept to grab. You're supposed to learn the instruction, and you're supposed to grow, and you're supposed to end up in wisdom. Now, something to remember is that we are planets apart socially, culturally, in just about every meaningful way, and not just by time or millennia. There are some portions of the Torah and the prophets and the writings, and to be fair, the New Testament, that simply will not translate to our modern way of life. Compare the definition for sexuality as being a man and a woman, the prohibitions against homosexuality in the Bible cover to cover, regardless of if you're Jewish or Christian, and it doesn't fit in our modern world, where we talk about a fluidity to gender and a fluidity to sexuality. And those are discussions that are currently taking place, and it would have been absurd to the people of, it would have been absurd 50 years ago, 100 years ago for sure, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, definitely to the people of the Bible. They would have understood it. And there are people today, I don't understand it. That discussion is happening all around us. So it's a different world. It's not a world full of email, fast item food. You push a button on your phone and food is delivered within 15 minutes. They wouldn't have understood it. They struggled for calories. They had to scrape and to work hard just to survive. Their literacy rate was 3%. Our rate of illiteracy is 3%. So most people can read. 97% of the population can read. 3% cannot. It was exact opposite. The world between the world of the Bible and our world today is radically different. And in some ways, that is always going to make us outsiders to the text itself. Now, the problem with the Tanakh is that if you don't know the Tanakh in all of its horror and gore, and I will tell you that there are horrific parts in the Hebrew Bible itself, and there's parts that look like they're from a horror novel. How can you begin to understand Christianity if you don't know your Bible? You can't understand even Islam and its influence and the importance of that, of the Bible for the influence in Islam, and for better or for worse, and richer or poorer, however you want to put that. Islam is a valid world religion with almost as many adherents as Christianity, and is a growing population of people that are Muslim. You probably know Muslims and get along with them just fine. And for Christians that know Muslims, and Jews too, there are lots of places that Muslims and Christians and Jews agree. In fact, throughout history, there have always been places where Muslims and Jews and Christians have agreed, and points that Christians and Muslims and Jews have agreed upon. And, if I dare say, there are positions that the heathen community has, which is growing and has returned in some ways, that they hold just as many ethical points that you would find affirming and welcoming as your own Ten Commandments, as your own principles. You could take the nine noble virtues from the Odinic rite, and they are ethical commands about how to act in the world, and there is nothing objectionable about it. In some ways, it's even more morally clear than, say, the Ten Commandments. So what I'm saying is that we have a lot in common, whether you're a Christian, whether you're a Jew, whether you're a Muslim, whatever your position is, whoever you are listening to this, and however you're listening, there's a lot in common. And we should celebrate those things and understand those things, and then really understand the differences and understand why different groups see things a different way, which is a question of hermeneutics, which is the next podcast. And I made that the next podcast because it really is that important. The Hebrew Bible is the foundation for Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Its large, deep influence has influenced the West. It influences our art, influences our drama, influences our literature. It's spread out through it. Its themes are duplicated and replayed over and over. It is the founding document for Western civilization. And in fact, that is what is being eroded and fought against in the postmodern era. It's trying to move away from the Judeo-Christian tradition and its influence. That's what they're at odds with. Now, that might look like Marxism. It might look like whatever you want to call that, wokenism. But in some ways, you could consider Marxism a materialist Christian heresy, where there's a middle period of time where the state takes over and you have socialism, and then in Marx's idea, the state would wither away and you would go back to this free period of time where you hunt, you fish, you smoke, you drink, you spend time talking about philosophy, and nobody has oppression over another person. And it's more of a free period. It's very similar, strikingly similar to the Christian concept of the millennial reign of Christ for 1,000 years and then the eternal kingdom that comes, that period after that. And in some ways, you could think of whatever that philosophy is in Marxism, it's also competing with the Christian worldview, which draws its from its sources in the Hebrew Bible itself. Religion is built on it. Our religions here are built on it. And of course, they aren't always the same. And the question we want to ask is, what does it actually say? Versus, what do the layers and layers of tradition say? And those are two different things. We want to go back to the text. And there's ways to do so and ways that we keep that in our front vision, and we want to look at, what does the text actually say? Not what we say that it says, and those things are different. And each religious tradition has its own way of doing that, and they have the reasons for doing that. Some appear valid, some perhaps not. And tradition itself, I should say, is not bad, it's not wrong, it's just tradition. It may not be clear, or it may evolve away from the actual text itself, and some sects even encourage this by having a low view of the text of the Bible itself. So what's so subversive about the Tanakh even after all this time? How do we grapple with it? How do we be defeated by it, like Jacob was, though he grappled with it and crippled the angel of the Lord in that passage? How are we molded by it? How are we shaped by it? How do we let it speak to us, at least from the position where we can decide if we're going to follow it? Let it speak and then decide. Deuteronomy tells us, I set before you life and death. Choose life. The choice is ours. You can hate it, you can love it, you can embrace it, you can despise it, but you have to choose. We choose our fate. That's what it means to be a free person. When it says what contradicts our cherished religions, or our cherished way of thinking, or our cherished ideologies, or our practices, that's how it's subversive. It undermines our assumptions, it undermines our inferences and way of being if we let it. And then we get to decide. So one of the things that I like to say, especially when I was teaching in a more academic setting, when I was teaching biblical studies, one of the things that I like to say was, hey, you don't have to like what the text says, but don't tell me it doesn't say that. And that actually relieved a lot of pressure from people. So you don't have to like the portions about Moses commanding the children of Israel to wipe out every Midian man, woman, and child. Every woman who has not known a man. How do you know that a woman has known a man? Well, have you ever been in public and seen a woman with a bump in her stomach? Generally, they call that a baby bump because she's pregnant, because she's known a man. So the passage tells us that they were commanded to wipe out men, women, pregnant women, children. Every woman who had known a man. It's horrific. It's horrible. It's okay for you to say that it's horrible. You don't have to agree with it. You don't have to like it. It's descriptive. It's not a command to us. It's a command. It was a command to them in their day and to age. But you don't have to agree. You don't have to like it. But don't tell me it doesn't say that. Okay. Or another way of saying it is, hey, don't spit in my face and tell me it's raining. Okay. We have to own that. We don't have to like it, but we have to own that. And that's part of the problem, is that you have these different religious traditions that try to tell you that the Bible says something that it doesn't say. And that's because they don't want it to say that. They want to say what they want to say, what the current year culture says. So a book may not be the most reasonable way to communicate, and this is a point often made by atheists, and there is some sense to it, to be honest. Maybe a space billboard that God had put up over the planet might have been a better way to communicate, but at the end of the day, who owns God? And the answer is no one. God isn't owned by anybody. He isn't the market, and he's not cornered. He's wild. God does what he wants. He is who he is. About this podcast and why I do it, and why should you listen to me? And my response to that is, you shouldn't. You should look for yourself. There are two attitudes that kill. And one is resentment, and one is arrogance. And I'm going to tell you the things your pastor either doesn't know or won't tell you. And that's part of what I'm doing here in this podcast. My point is that you've been sold a set of goods, an idealized and sanitized version of truth and history that seeks your compliance, seeks your will, your wealth, and for you to pursue the selfish interests of others over your own interests. God and his book have been weaponized against you in many cases. The religious leaders, that's our priestly caste, they either know this or they are complicit in it, or they're blindly and willfully ignorant of it. And there's really no excuse in this day and age. And either way, the result is the same. Your compliance. They gift you with certainty, and certainty on how life works, how God works, and what you have to do, your place in the world, and the world to come. But it really isn't a gift. It's a chain packaged as a benefit. But if they can weaponize the Bible, so can we. We can use it as a shield and spear. The truth can indeed set you free if you are courageous enough to hear it and to seek it. If you understand the Hebrew Bible, then you understand how it's been used, abused, distorted, and twisted to meet someone else's agenda. It's been weaponized against you to make you work against your own interests, and that's what this is about, giving you the tools to understand your chains and escape them and subvert the lies on the lips of the priests. To understand the text in its context and see through the stories of the storytellers meant to weave you into their way of thinking about the world. The point is really kind of simple. Think for yourself. Read the text for yourself. You can do this. This is not a complicated text. This isn't how do we engineer rockets to get up to Mars. This isn't complex mathematics. It's not chaos theory. It's not things that are hard and difficult. In fact, the Bible itself tells you that the message itself is not too difficult for you. You can do this. This is exactly what God says. He says, you don't have to cross mountain. Don't have to cross ocean. Don't have to cross land. The word is near you. It is in your mouth even now. Meaning, you can do this. It's not hard for you to understand. If a people who were illiterate, who were in an agrarian society, mostly subsistence living, if they could understand it, then certainly you can today. You have so many more tools available to you, from lexicons to linguistic tools to study tools to hermeneutical understandings and teachings and instruction. You have so many tools available to you. You can understand this. It's not too difficult for you. Problem is, you simply have to try. And that's what I'm here to do. I'm here to encourage you to try. I'm here to talk about these issues and go over some of my favorite and hopefully more interesting topics and tell you the things that your pastor doesn't know. And most of the time, your pastor is not a bad dude. And most of the times, your pastor is a dude. But your pastors aren't bad people most of the time. They're just busy. They are taking care of people. They're doing six jobs for the price of one. And this isn't to malign pastors or to malign Christianity, even. It's to show where those pieces don't fit, where you've been told they fit, but they don't fit, and you have to reevaluate for yourself. Who are you going to believe? You're going to believe your eyes? You're going to believe what you're told? Or are you going to believe what you're reading, which you can handle yourself? This is accessible and available, and you can do this. So this is the inaugural journey. Thank you for being with me, and let's wander through the wilderness a little bit, hopefully not for 40 years. And let's understand the text and what the Hebrew Bible has to say to us. It's the key to understanding, yes, the Bible. It's the key to understanding Jesus. And if you're a Christian, you want to understand Jesus. You want to know what he thought about things. You want to know how he acted. What was his worldview? How did he behave? What did he expect? What did he want? What was he about? What was his mission? The things that he said. Where did he say that from? Where did he get that from? Why did he say that? Those things had a context to them and a nuance to them that we miss. And if you don't know the ancient Near Eastern tradition, you don't know the cultural background, the economics, the politics, and the text tradition that we have, and we have a very stable Hebrew Bible, a very stable text. and it's been very stable for a very long time. And it's solid. It's more solid than the New Testament is, and more solid than Islam, though there's some different reasons, and it's a different tradition. Islam's book, the Quran, is not the same type of book as the Bible itself, and that means both Hebrew Bible and New Testament. Very, very different type of book, arranged differently in a different context, in a different situation. And I'm not here to focus a lot on that, but it is a different book, but it does also influence, the Hebrew Bible does, of course, influence Islam itself. Moses is their prophet too. And they accept all the same prophets that the Jewish tradition does. And they're a part of that tradition too, of people who understand and appreciate the Hebrew Bible. Until next time, I am your subversive scribe, Hesh. And I'm telling you to stay subversive and read deeply. And we'll see you in the next one. Thanks. Thanks for listening. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. Support for the Subversive Scribe comes from private subscribers, generous supporters, and a community of inquiring people who are willing to take the biblical texts seriously and subversively. Join the Scriven Insurgents, the private community built for Subversive Scribe podcast subscribers, on our Locals page at subversivescribe.locals.com. Click on Become a Supporter, and for $5 a month as a member of the Scriven Insurgents, you get access to private Subversive Scribe episodes, teaching series, audible commentaries, and exclusive content. Your support makes the Subversive Scribe podcast possible. Join the Scriven Insurgents and stay subversive.